Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LPFM, Portsmouth Community Radio 106.1 FM. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, October 1st, 2005. Here's what's coming up for today's show. In our first hour, Steve Diamond will check back in with Tom Jackson about last week's anti-war demonstrations and lobbying efforts in D.C. about the war on Iraq. Following that, we'll have an episode of Down to Earth with Jeff White, focusing on the latest info about ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Our second hour will feature an interview with Cindy and Craig Corey, parents of International Solidarity Movement volunteer Rachel Corey, who was killed in the Gaza Strip in Palestine on March 16, 2003, trying to prevent the demolition of the home of a Palestinian family. We'll also have announcements, music, and more. First, let's hear some news. Let's begin today with some local news. From the Concord Monitor, vigilant for peace, passionate for his vigil. Supporters continue as activist hospitalized. Don Booth, the 88-year-old Canterbury Quaker who's held a one-man peace vigil in front of the statehouse nearly every day since tensions with Iraq erupted, had open-heart surgery on Wednesday. He was admitted to Concord Hospital last week with congestive heart failure, friends and family said. Fellow activist Mary Sargent of Bow said one of his first concerns was the continuation of the hour-long lunchtime vigil. Don's about to have open-heart surgery, and there he is worried that the vigil will die without him, Sargent said. But it hasn't. Yesterday, five like-minded people stood on Booth's swath of sidewalk, holding signs he meticulously wrote and painted, including a rainbow-colored banner reading, "We the People, with the wisdom of common sense and the gentle energy of love, can find a way to freedom from domination, lies, and war." Gracia Berry of Concord, from behind the sign, said, "You see the gentle energy of love? That's Don." Dick DeSev of Gilmanton said, "We wanted to send a message to him so he knows that we're saving his spot for him. It's a spot Booth cherishes, though he said yesterday from his hospital bed that he spent many hours questioning whether his statement makes sense. He's decided that it does." "In the last year or so, there's been a lot of expression from people who appreciate what we're doing," Booth said in labored but deliberate speech. The grassroots organization, New Hampshire Peace Action, has held weekly vigils since 1980, but it was Booth who began going every day. After a car accident 12 years ago forced him to retire as a builder of environmentally friendly homes and left him with physical limitations and a speech impediment, friends and family said Booth turned to making signs. And when the federal government began talking about war in Iraq, Booth turned to the corner of Park and Main streets. Booth has believed in that message since he was a young man. He was a conscientious objector during World War II, despite the disapproval of his traveling salesman father, said Booth's wife, Lois. Instead of fighting in Europe, Booth worked in civilian public service camps doing projects such as logging and construction. It was there that he first met people passionate about peace. The work camps were a great gift to the peace movement because they put together people from all backgrounds who were opposed to the war, and we nurtured each other, Booth said. I learned a huge amount in those camps. Lois Booth also opposed the war. The couple was married in 1946 and had six children. In the 1950s, they moved from one communal living community to another, some of which were racially integrated, and they eventually started a small-scale one of their own in Canterbury. They shared resources and grew their own food. Booth was working as a carpenter, and he and some of the men decided to start their own business, Community Builders. For the next several decades, Booth pioneered the use of solar energy to heat homes. He wrote two books on the subject, one of which focused on the envelope house, or a house built within a house to keep in the heat. His son Steve also works in the construction business. It was just finding the most sensible way to build useful, durable houses, Booth said. Using sunshine instead of oil is good sense. Booth has always stood up for his views. In 1963, he marched on Washington and heard Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous I Have a Dream speech. He was involved in the demonstrations against the Seabrook nuclear power plant in 1986 and was arrested in 2001 for protesting a Manchester company, BAE Systems, that makes weapons and supplies for the military. Booth was arrested again 3 months ago for refusing to leave a sit-in at Senator Judd Gregg's office in Concord. Sargent, who was also arrested, said participants sat and read the names of Americans and Iraqis killed in the war. Booth began his most recent streak of afternoon vigils a few years ago when, he said, it became apparent that the federal government's sanctions on Iraq were keeping food, water, and medicine from the Iraqi people. But instead of scolding the president, Booth said he chooses his message carefully. His sign began with a sentence, "President Bush, I do not stand united with you." It went on to say there were better ways to meet the world's needs. "I prefer to say useful things," he said. When asked why, Booth smiled. It needed to be said. Our next story is from the Associated Press. Army faces uncertain outlook after one of its worst recruiting years in decades. The Army is closing the books on one of the leanest recruiting years since it became an all-volunteer service 3 decades ago. Officials insist the slump is not a crisis. Michael O'Hanlon, a defense analyst at the Brookings Institution think tank, said the recruiting shortfall this year does not matter greatly, for now. The bad news is that any shortfall shows how hard it would be to increase the Army's size by 50,000 or more, as many of us think appropriate, O'Hanlon said. We appear to have waited too long to try. The Army has not published official figures yet, but it apparently finished the 12-month counting period that ends Friday with about 73,000 recruits. Its goal was 80,000. A gap of 7,000 enlistees would be the largest in absolute number as well as in percentage since 1979. The Army National Guard and the Army Reserve, which are smaller than the regular Army, had even worse results. There are compelling reasons to think that Army recruiters are heading into a second consecutive year of recruiting shortfalls. The outlook is dimmed by several key factors, including daily reports of American deaths in Iraq and the uncertain nature of the struggle against the insurgency have put a damper on young people's enthusiasm for joining the military, according to opinion surveys. The Army has a smaller-than-usual reserve of enlistees as it begins the new recruiting year on Saturday. This pool comes from what the Army calls its delayed entry program, in which recruits commit to join the Army on the condition that they ship to boot camp some months later. Normally, that pool is large enough at the start of the recruiting year to fill one quarter of the Army's full-year need, but it has dwindled so low that the Army is starting its new recruiting year with perhaps only 5% in the bank. The factors working against the Army, Helfferty said, are a strong national economy that offers young people other choices and continued negative news from the Middle East. To offset that, the Army has vastly increased the number of recruiters on the street, offered bigger sign-up bonuses, and boosted advertising. From The Guardian, fears over climate as Arctic ice melts at record level. Global warming in the Arctic could be soaring out of control, scientists warned, as new figures revealed that melting of sea ice in the region has accelerated to record levels. The satellite image released by NASA shows the minimum concentration of Arctic sea ice in 2005 occurring on September 21, 2005. New satellite observations show that sea ice in the Arctic is melting faster while air temperatures in the region are rising sharply. Since 2002, satellite data have revealed unusually early springtime melting in areas north of Siberia and Alaska. Now the melting trend has spread throughout the Arctic, according to a national collaboration of scientists' studies released by the University of Colorado. Experts at the U.S. National Snow and Data Center in Colorado fear the region is locked into a destructive cycle with warmer air melting more ice, which in turn warms the air further. If the current trend continues, the summertime Arctic Ocean will be completely ice-free well before the end of this century. Ted Scambos, lead scientist at the Colorado Center, said melting sea ice accelerates warming because dark-colored water absorbs heat from the sun that was previously reflected back into space by white ice. He said, "Feedbacks in the system are starting to take hold. We could see changes in Arctic ice happening much sooner than we thought, and that is important because without the ice cover over the Arctic Ocean, we have to expect big changes in Earth's weather." Walt Meyer, also at the Colorado Center, said, "Having 4 years in a row with such low ice extents has never been seen before in the satellite record. It clearly indicates a downward trend, not just a short-term anomaly." The notorious Northwest Passage through the Canadian Arctic from Europe to Asia was completely open this summer, except for a 60-mile swath of scattered ice floes. The Northeast Passage, north of the Siberian coast, has been ice-free since August 15th. Springtime melting in the Arctic has begun much earlier in recent years. This year it started 17 days earlier than expected. The winter rebound of ice, where seawater refreezes, has also been affected. The decline threatens wildlife in the region, including polar bears that spend the summer on land before returning to the ice when it reforms in winter. It is also the latest in a series of discoveries that have raised the specter of environmental tipping points, critical thresholds beyond which the climate would be unable to recover. We now go to Steve Diamond and his follow-up interview with Tom Jackson on last week's anti-war lobbying efforts in D.C.
I'm speaking with Tom Jackson of Joe Public Films. He was recently in Washington, D.C. for the big anti-war demonstration. And after that, he was also involved in some lobbying of our congressional representatives. So, Tom, how did that go? Who did you see first?
Well, as it turned out, I met with staffers, although that wasn't originally my understanding of the way it was going to go. The first two meetings were with House representatives from New Hampshire, first one being with Charlie Bass's office. And although I'm not a constituent, I was kind of down there as not only a New Hampshire citizen, but representing Peace Action in New Hampshire. So I felt as though it would be okay for me to go in to the House Rep's office from a different district than mine. I mean, we can kind of sum up what happened, generally speaking, as far as the politics of all of this goes pretty quickly. United for Peace and Justice, which organized the lobbying days on the Monday following the Saturday, September 24th March in D.C., basically had us going in and going through a fairly brief list of things that we were demanding. First of all, being an immediate withdrawal of troops, U.S. troops from Iraq. A couple of the other issues that were presented by us included changing the clause in the No Child Left Behind law that allows recruitment in high schools. Right now, a parent has to opt out to prevent children from, or their child from, being recruited. And what we were asking for through United for Peace and Justice is an opt-in situation, and none of the Congress people were willing to do that. None of them, you know, agreed to that change. None of them agreed to or seemed to indicate anything to the effect that they would be presenting legislation to get our troops out of Iraq. None of them were willing to say that they would not support permanent military bases, permanent troop presences in Iraq. None of them would agree to putting out legislation that would give Iraqi civilians that were injured or families of civilians killed in our operations over there some sort of, you know, compensation or something to that effect. And they also, none of them would agree to putting out legislation that would go to actual funding of rebuilding for individuals, you know, people whose homes were destroyed and things like that. They weren't interested in anything along those lines. So basically the demands, or whatever you want to call them, of United for Peace and Justice were all rejected by the four New Hampshire congressional offices that I visited. But that wasn't really all that surprising to me, quite frankly. What was a little bit of a surprise and rather frustrating was, I went in there knowing that with the House representatives, I was going to be meeting with staffers because the House didn't have any kind of vote coming up that day. And I was told when I made the appointments that the House reps themselves would not be there in their offices. So I figured I'm just going to be meeting with the staffers.
When I spoke with you at the last show, when you were in the march in Washington, you said you were pleasantly surprised. This sounded like you would actually meet with congresspeople, two of them. You said it was Greg and...
Right. Well, on the Senate side, I was given the impression... With Sununu, they were a little bit guarded. They said, we could probably get you in with Sununu. I'll schedule you with the senator, and the secretary was a little guarded and said, sometimes things come up and we may have to put you with a staffer, and we'll see, but we'll do our best to get you in with the senator, Sununu. And that one actually didn't work out. He was there. He came flying through the entrance to his office and went right into his own office space in about, two or three steps over what was a pretty sizable amount of acreage. I was sitting there on the couch out in the waiting area, waiting, thinking that I was going to meet with him. But as it turned out, I didn't. But the one that sort of takes the cake for me was the whole thing with Judd Gregg's office. I said in my email to them, I want to meet with Judd Gregg, very specifically. And they emailed back and said, okay, here's the time. I even had a couple of follow-up emails with his scheduler and whoever it was that I was dealing with, saying, do I have time to make it from the House side over to the Senate side, which is, not a tremendously long walk, but a little bit of a walk. So we fine-tuned the time to 11:30 on Monday morning to meet with Judd Gregg. Nothing was ever said about not meeting with the senator himself, and so I had the impression that I was going to be meeting with him, which is not really so unusual, particularly on a day when all of Congress knows there's a tremendous effort going on to meet with congresspeople and talk about the situation in Iraq. So... Basically, I get down to D.C., and I'm staying with two people, actually a family that lives over the border in Maryland, and one of them happens to be the organizer of the United for Peace and Justice Lobby Days. She told me at one point that the Jim Lehrer NewsHour had contacted her and wanted to go in with somebody or a group of people and film a meeting between a group of anti-war people and a basically pro-war senator. And so they had arranged something with Senator Lugar's office out of Indiana, and they talked about getting Cindy Sheehan possibly in as a sort of guest along with the Indiana delegation. But at first, Senator Lugar's office, as of, I think, Friday, they were saying, you can only come in here and do a photo op, and that's it. No taping, no nothing. And Jim Lehrer NewsHour really wanted to tape, the whole thing and be able to broadcast something. So this person from United for Peace and Justice connected them with me and said, talk to Tom Jackson. He's going and visiting with Judd Gregg. And so they contacted me, and I, of course, gave the okay. I was fine with the idea of the cameras coming in. And the producer said, we've got to check with the senator's office. So I was pretty doubtful that it would be okay. Well, I didn't, neither the producer from Jim Lehrer nor I checked in with each other until a little while before the meeting on Monday. But I called him up, and he said, they said no. Judd Gregg's office said no, absolutely not. Not even a photo op. And as it turned out, Lugar's office let them in, and they did a minimal amount of taping. But it concerned me and bothered me that Judd Gregg's office had said a flat-out no. And the other thing that the producer from Jim Lehrer told me, which no one from Gregg's office told me, was that Gregg had gone out of town for the day. And so this, you know, this was news to me. And so, you know, this is all taking place. I'm talking to him on my cell phone outside of the Russell Senate office building. And so I went inside and, you know, sure enough, I'm talking with two staffers in a conference room, and a couple other people from American Friends Service Committee joined me because they were interested in meeting with that particular office. And I got the same responses, the same basic things that I expected, which was they're not interested in, you know, anything to do with getting troops out of Iraq or funding, trying to help Iraqis on the ground. And so, you know, basically we wound up in a situation where not only did they refuse to let the press in, but they also refused to meet with me. The senator refuses to meet with me. And, you know, this is an ongoing pattern. This isn't just, you know, a one-time situation. It just happened not that long ago when some people from New Hampshire Peace Action did a sit-in in Greg's office. And, you know, before and afterwards, they called for an open and public debate, you know, preferably something televised, but some sort of open and public debate between a few individuals from the peace community and Senator Gregg, and he has refused, or, you know, either flat out refused or just not responded at all. And so, you know, this is just one more example in a long-standing pattern where apparently it's just not, you know, not a priority for him to think about peace, to talk about peace, to talk with people who are concerned with what's happening to our troops, to Iraqi civilians, and so on over in Iraq.
You're talking about the Newington Five case, which occurred before the war even started, the second war.
Well, there was that too. The one I was referring to, there was a group of people, I think it was the Chain Reaction Group, but a small group of people from New Hampshire Peace Action just a couple of months ago did a sit-in, I think in the Concord office of Judd Gregg. But then, of course, you're right, before that, in October 2002, was the Newington Five, which I was a part of. You know, this is not a priority for him, or you know, really, I think it's not any stretch to say he's afraid to talk publicly and, you know, in the public eye about this issue. Maybe it's because, you know, he knows he's wrong about it. Maybe he just, who knows? I don't know for sure. I mean, but I would like to once again publicly invite him to debate. And not just, I mean, we can go on and on about in hindsight, the merits or lack thereof of going into Iraq in the first place, and you can probably guess where I'd come from on that one. But in this meeting with the staffers, I was keeping it very, you know, present tense and future tense, because, you know, you can go on and on about what's already happened, but right now I think that the peace activist community is really looking towards, you know, we need to get our troops out of there now, and, you know, and not have any more killing going on there.
It sounds like at the demonstration in Washington, politicians were extraordinarily scarce. Both Democratic leaders, other than Cynthia McKinney and Jesse Jackson and a few others, for the most part, everyone, all the Democrats said that they were on vacation or out of town or had other engagements. But it sounds also like most of the Congress people claim to not be around. Would you say that were they being unusually scarce and unresponsive and to their constituents? Or it sounds like, from what you said about Gregg and previous attempts to reach him, that maybe this is more a pattern.
Yeah, I think it's a pattern. I mean, there were some people who, you know, some Congress people who met with their constituents. Wasn't anywhere near a majority by any means. But as I mentioned, Lugar's office did wind up meeting with the Indiana contingent. They did wind up allowing a little bit of taping. I'm not even sure if anything aired on the Lara News Hour or not. And they let Cindy Sheehan come in with the Indiana group. And Lugar himself was there to talk with them. So, you know, that's one example of where it did work out. But my impression was that that politicians were pretty scarce. Barbara Lee was around for some of the events through the whole thing. At the lobbying training day, which was Sunday, that United for Peace and Justice put on before the actual lobbying days, one of the people there was a guy from John Conyers' office, and you know, but that's no surprise. Conyers has been terrific in terms of his foreign policy or criticism of U.S. foreign policy for years. But for the most part, I would say yes, there was a lack of politicians present, and that yes, indeed, it is a pattern. You know, it's an ongoing thing, and it's not a partisan thing. That's one of the big frustrations for many of us. I'm sure you know this as well as anybody else. You know, when we're talking Republicans, not every single Republican actually is in favor of what's going on in Iraq. I mean, Ron Paul from Texas is a Republican, but he's not in favor of what's happening. There's been some others that have come out against the ongoing occupation of Iraq. And, you know, conversely, Democrats, there's a lot of Democrats who are just, you know, laying low, and, you know, they either don't know what position to take, or they're sticking with their, you know, war position or whatever. And it's definitely a frustrating time in terms of trying to communicate with our politicians.
It's almost understandable that Greg and others would be so unresponsive years ago when the war was starting, when there was so much anger and such a wish among many to lash out, even if in a misdirected way, about 9/11. But now that opinion polls have changed so much, and the majority clearly opposes the war, and there doesn't seem to be an exit strategy or any real end point when Bush says we're fighting for democracy everywhere, I think very few people see that there's this will ever end or see it as clearly defined. What will make an impression on these congresspeople if and when we do get to actually corner them and speak to them? Or are they eventually just going to be irrelevant and we have to try to bring about change some other way? So my question is, what do you think they might respond to, congresspeople? And if they won't, at what point should we focus more on other means?
Well, there's a few things that I think they'd respond to. I think they'd respond to being voted out of office. I think they'd respond to, and you know, why wait for that? I think that they would respond to an organized, open tax resistance, whether it's war tax resistance or full tax resistance. You know, that's a language that that many people in D.C. speak, the language of money. And, you know, Alexander Haig, who was part of the Reagan administration, is famous for saying when there was a huge protest in 1982 in New York City against Reagan's Central American foreign policy, Haig said, let them protest all they want as long as they pay their taxes. And, you know, I think there's really something to that. I know that it's kind of a scary thought for some people to, you know, to think not paying their taxes and they're going to go to jail or they're going to get things taken away from them. I think that if it was a large scale and open tax revolt, then that would make a tremendous impression. And in terms of the enforcement, I'm skeptical about that. But additional ideas, I mean, we need to. There was one sort of phrasing of the whole approach or a counter approach to the way, you know, many politicians are still saying, well, you need to support our troops, okay? And for many of us, you know, we've had the phrase support our troops, bring them home for quite a while now. But added to that, I was hearing some people involved with the whole United for Peace and Justice lobbying talking about how when politicians do that now with what is so clearly a failed policy, what our response needs to be is that they are hiding behind our troops. Basically what they're saying is support our troops, and they're hiding behind them and using the troops as human shields to try to hide from a failed policy. And you know, I agree with that, and I do think that that's what a lot of them are doing. They don't know how to handle this. They don't know how to get out of the whole situation.
So those are some ideas on what to do about Congress people and other representatives who overtly support the war and feel like perhaps feel like they can't change no matter what the common sense situation is. What about politicians who don't particularly support the war or seem to be afraid to speak at all about the issue and are just waiting for the Republicans to lose popularity completely on their own on their own policy? How can we urge Democrats and others to take a firmer stance?
Well, that's a good question, and I think it's surprising to me that more of them haven't seen that the tide has turned. You know, it isn't just turning; it isn't just in sort of on the way there. They need to jump on the wave now that it's starting to crest. You know, if they really do, you know, have a sincere desire to get our troops out of there and to create a different situation in Iraq than just constant violence and so on, then now's the time. I don't think that being afraid for their political career, yeah, that's not something I could get behind before, but now it doesn't even make sense anymore. The tide has turned and it's not going to turn back again. They need to get on the right side of things, one way or another, and now's the time. One of the things that that the staffer in Judd Gregg's office was saying to me was, he was basically trying to turn the questions around and say how, don't they have more democracy now than they did before in Iraq? And, I didn't really anticipate that question so much as a support our troops type thing. Although it's pretty predictable that he would say something like that. And it was the one moment where I almost lost my composure a little bit. You know, basically I just said, I'm not even going to go there, because even if you want to call some of the changes that have happened politically democracy, it just, to the people on the streets in Iraq, nothing has changed. Or if it's changed, it's changed for the worse. They have worse water in Baghdad now. They have less electricity than they used to. It's more like, Basra was for years and years. And not only that, there's constant violence out in the streets. So if you want to call it democracy, you're certainly going to go ahead, because that's been what these folks have been doing who are in support of what we're doing there. But I don't see it that way, and I don't even want to go into those sort of terms, because if nothing else, so-called democracy under occupation seems like it, to people like me and to probably an awful lot of Iraqis, like an oxymoron, And I said to him, "Don't you think?" And he sort of looked at me and nodded a little bit and changed the subject, So I think that there are plenty of ways that we can not only try to talk and communicate different ideas to people, including people who are completely on the other side of things. But there's also, I think that some of them can be reached to a certain extent. We just have to keep on doing it. It has to be constant, because otherwise I can look to people who I know personally who have conservative views, and that they'll sort of slide on back into the default unless we keep after them and keep talking to them and keep appealing to something that's inside of them that's human, and it is there, and it's just it takes a lot of energy and a lot of persistence, and so that's one thing that I think that we can do.
Sounds like we need to do a lot of building of real democracy here before we work on real democracy in Iraq, if we even have the legitimacy to try to do that.
Yeah, that would probably be a pretty good idea, And one of the other points that I made, I think, in all four offices, was that, and the staffer at Gregg's office sort of fired this thing at me that the UN doesn't even want to be involved. Well, there's a reason for that. It isn't just that the UN is lazy or something like that. It's because of that whole perception that we've gone in there as the U.S. big unilateral superpower doing whatever it wants and grabbing the oil, why would the U.N. want to support that? Why would they want to be involved with that? They've basically taken a sort of, you've made your bed, you're going to lie in it sort of policy. But if a situation was created where it was very clear that what we were now looking for, that the policy had genuinely changed, and what we were now looking for is some sort of multinational effort to actually help the Iraqi people and rebuild Iraq on a fair basis, on a basis that actually is geared to help the Iraqis and not help Halliburton and Bechtel and Blackwater, companies like those, then I think that, the rest of the world might get in on that, and I think that that's one step towards helping them, helping the people of Iraq get to a point where they can handle things on their own. They do need the help in terms of investment and rebuilding and things like that. And I think if there was some sort of presence there that was multinational, with a very limited time period that was very clear, then that would make for a better transition. There is some legitimate concern for a civil war if there's suddenly nobody there. But there again, that's something that gets trotted out quite a bit. I think it's a very cynical argument on the part of people who support the invasion and occupation of Iraq, because I'm skeptical that they really care that much about the Iraqi people. But that's sort of a whole different issue of when we get involved in other people's civil wars and when we don't.
Tom Jackson of Joe Public Films, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
And now to Jeff White with Down to Earth, Environmental Programming.
Good afternoon and welcome to Down to Earth on Making Waves. My name is Jeff White and I'm sitting here in Concord, New Hampshire at the Sierra Club office. And I'm sitting with Emily Templin, who is a conservation organizer of the New Hampshire Sierra Club. And she's going to tell us a little bit about the latest with the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. As some of you know, it's been under fire from the Bush administration and Senator Gregg and others. And she's going to fill us in on the specifics of this important issue and give us an update of what happened this week in Washington, D.C., where there was a big rally in support of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Emily, welcome to Down to Earth.
Great. Thanks for being here, Jeff. And as we know, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is a very important place to Americans, to all Americans. It's over 19 million acre refuge, and 1.5 million acres of it are actually on the coastal plain in Alaska. And that is the specific area that's under target for drilling here. And it is one of the largest untracked wilderness areas left in our country. This vast wild landscape that is important to Americans and to our country and to our world for a variety of different reasons. And right now, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is under fire, as you said, as it has been for years and years. And now they're really taking one of the last backdoor approaches and really trying to pass drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which would destroy this vast landscape.
And so this is intensifying this battle right now as we speak.
It is. What's going on right now is that drilling proponents are really trying to use any vehicle possible to advance their agenda and to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And so right now, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is included in the budget reconciliation package, which is a backdoor approach to passing and allowing for drilling in the Arctic Refuge. And it completely circumvents the process of our democracy here. It does not allow for public input. It does not, and it is just really snuck into our budget process.
Can you explain a little more about that budget? You said the budget reconciliation.
It is. It's the budget reconciliation package, and it will be voted on by Congress. So the Senate and the House both have to approve this budget. And you may remember that there was a budget bill passed this spring, and so that included the Arctic, but that simply made it possible for them to include revenues from drilling in the Arctic. But what the budget reconciliation package does is it provides more teeth, where it provides policy for them to actually go into the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and to start drilling there. And so this is really the last and final big vote here. And as we were talking about, you mentioned that there's been a lot of things going on here this past week. Just yesterday, there was a rally in Washington, D.C., Arctic Action Day, that took place. And there were, from all accounts, 3,000 to 5,000 people that turned out on the lawn in Washington, D.C., rallying to protect the Arctic. They had a whole host of different speakers that came out in support of protecting the Arctic and speaking to the people that traveled there. There are actually 50 students that loaded a bus on Monday evening at like 10 o'clock from UNH, and they rode the bus overnight. They arrived in D.C. at 9:30 or so the next day and were there for the rally, and then they loaded the bus last night and returned about 4:30 this morning.
50 students.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Great showing for you, for New Hampshire, especially because I think a lot of people, you might want to talk about this at some point a little bit more, but why would somebody from New Hampshire care about something that's, I mean, let's face it, it's tundra, it's not really land that's being used, so we've heard that it's possible to drill on it without damaging the environment, and maybe you could talk about that at some point in our discussion here, but I find it amazing that 50 students, college students, because you always hear how apathetic they are.
Right,
and
exactly.
And they actually cared enough, despite what all the other things that are going on with Iraq and Hurricane Katrina and all the other news. Obviously, this is not making big headlines, and I'm sure that that wasn't even covered in the mainstream news, so, yeah.
Right, exactly. It wasn't. Yeah, it was very exciting. And then there were also several just independent citizens that flew down, and then they met with all of our delegations, so both senators and congressmen, which was very exciting. And then when they were there, they heard from Kerry, Lincoln Chafee, and Hillary Clinton came out, and I guess it went like an hour over because people were just so jazzed and talking, and then they all hit the hill in their blue t-shirts, so yeah, it was a very exciting day. And actually, the timing with this vote on the budget reconciliation package, it was supposed to be voted on sometime this week. But as you're talking about, there are a lot of things that are going on in our world right now, and so they have pushed back the vote, and they're expecting that it'll be voted on the end of October, so the last week in October, beginning of November.
So now, right around Halloween.
Yeah, exactly.
Something really beautiful or something really horrible.
Right. Quite a trick it is.
Exactly.
Pushing it through.
Treat the oil industry and trick us into thinking it's a good thing.
Right.
So there is time. I mean, it seems like, well, it's like 6 weeks away, so that's good, and that there could be more preparation, to go against this and to fight this.
Exactly. And that is something that everyone listening, there's time, and the most important thing that people can do right now is to call their representatives about this. And if you grab pieces of paper and pencils and things, I'll give you the number here at time. So I'll do it right now. So let's see. Congressman Bradley, his phone number in D.C. is 202-225-5456. So that's 202-225-5456. And that's Representative Jeb Bradley. And then Congressman Charlie Bass, his phone number is 202-225-5206. So Congressman Charlie Bass is 202-225-5206. And then we have the senator. So Senator Sununu is 202-224-2841. So Senator Sununu, 202-224-2841. And Senator Gregg is 202-224-3324. So again, that's Senator Gregg at 202-224-3324.
And it probably makes a lot of sense to call their Washington office, is that correct? Just because they're probably spending a lot of time there.
It does, and right now they're going to be there, basically.
So rather than calling the local office, it's better. It's probably going to get, they'll probably get the message clearer.
Quicker, exactly, exactly. If they're in their office and they hear their phone ringing off the hook and they know it's about the Arctic, that's what we want. So as close to them as we can get, yeah. And then you were mentioning how people think this is just this vast, tundra, ice field. I've heard all kinds of different rhetoric about this, and that is just simply not true. There is the second largest herd of caribou that are on the coastal plain. And then you also see pictures and things of these caribou migrating and being able to go underneath the large oil tubes and pipes and things that would be in place. And that is also another myth, because the men would go underneath it, and the women, but then the babies would be left behind as the next generation is not able to go with their parents and so forth. That is a serious problem. There also are migratory birds. There are several species that stop here in New Hampshire. And so as to why it's important to us here in New Hampshire, there are many birds that make the long flight all the way from Alaska
really?
To New Hampshire. Yeah.
It's really amazing.
Yeah, so they stop through here, and yeah, it is. And there's just the diversity of wildlife. They're actually the polar bears. It's one of the only places where they den on shore. And they build their dens. There's just so, and then there are also wolves and many other species there. One, and then also one of the other really important things to remember about this is that is important to the Gwich'in people, which is the native tribe that lives in that area. And they are really dependent on this wildlife for their way of living, for their medicine, for their clothing, for their food, everything. They still live a lifestyle, unlike the rest of us, that is very dependent on the land. And not only would be destroying this amazing landscape and one of the only places in the world that remains untouched, we'd be destroying the lives of these people. And so there are many reasons why we love this area and that it's so important to us. And the other really important thing, and to me that is just so critical about this, is that if we were to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling, it would set a precedent that we'd be able to open up other public lands that have been protected for the American people. And our public land system here in America is something that we should be very proud of, and that is very unique. And it's something that we take for granted, whether it's just going to take a hike at our local state park or exploring the White Mountains and so forth. So we start opening up one place, next there'll be clear cutting the White Mountains,
And they've done that in the past.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So
exactly.
In other words, nothing would be sacred. It would all be open. And I've heard a lot about that. And there's a lot of people who would say that's the goal of our current administration, is to privatize everything, including Yellowstone and all the national parks, and to allow the plunder of the natural resources in those places and to commercialize the recreation aspect of it. What I've heard is called the Disneyfication of wilderness, where you create this wonderland, and of course it's controlled by all these corporations and defunded by feds. Yeah, so this is a much bigger issue than
it is a much bigger
just
issue.
Alaska and Arctic.
Right, and it is something that if they do this, that we will, it really opens up the door to a lot of things that could happen to our public lands.
I've also heard, interestingly, that a lot of the people that support this are saying, well, it's because it's in Alaska, it's especially the governor of Alaska and the senators that they want to do this. And what I think people tend to forget is it's a national wildlife refuge. It's not Alaska state wildlife refuge.
Exactly.
They get money from all our tax dollars to protect this area and to administer the protection and so forth, and it's being treated as if it's some local resource, and they're all up in arms that being told what they can and can't do with their land. But it's kind of like telling the people of California all of a sudden saying, well, Yosemite's ours and we're just going to drill in it, and that's obviously not going to fly with most Americans anyway. So,
right.
But this being so removed from the public eye, and I think you have a good point, and that's why this is going to open up a huge, I guess, Pandora's box, whatever, to our national lands.
Right, exactly. And also when talking about that, they talk about the funds and things that would come from this and the money and so forth, but in reality that's also just another big myth. And so basically the leasing revenues from this are very speculative, and the numbers that the drilling boosters are really just like pie in the sky. They make no sense, not reality at all. And so the president's budget assumes a $2.4 billion to be split between the state of Alaska and the federal government. So if we're talking about, well, we go back to Alaska here. But given that the oil leases on the north slope of Alaska have historically sold for about $50 an acre, this figure is completely inflated by 80 times the current average. So really the amount that would be going back to the state of Alaska and to our federal government is very small.
So even let's say it was $1 billion, I'm trying to remember how much we spend in Iraq every month.
Right.
On protect, you know, it's just...
Right.
It's, and this isn't going to... I mean, can you speak a little bit about... There's also the myth that this will make us more independent.
Right.
What is your opinion, or what is the information on that, the latest on that? Because that's what a lot of people are saying, especially with oil prices going up and the Middle
East
having us kind of in a headlock, saying, you know, we're going to basically use this to have power over the American people.
Exactly. And the reality is that oil from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge would do absolutely nothing to ease our oil prices now and to drop oil prices. And this is actually according to the U.S. Department of Energy's own Energy Information Administration, so the EIA. And so in a March report in 2004, the analysis of oil and gas production in Arctic National Wildlife Refuge found that only 0.3% of the oil produced in Arctic Refuge is... okay, I'll say that again. So the Arctic Refuge oil would only be 0.3% of the total world oil production, which is very small. And that would take, as the U.S. Geological Survey's best estimates, it would take 10 years for that oil to come online, and there would only be a six-month supply. And so we're really just talking about a very, very small amount of oil that is here. And so even when production peaked, so like if they started drilling now, production wouldn't peak until 2025, by the time they get all the infrastructure in place and so forth. And then it would make up only 0.7%, so 0.7% of world oil production, and only 3% of U.S. oil consumption. And then it would just diminish steadily after 2025. So we're really just talking about a very, very small amount. I think another interesting fact right now is that we're talking about the rise in gas prices, and we're seeing how dependent our country is on gas and oil. And really, if we drilled in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, at the best estimates, by the time the oil came online and so forth, it would only reduce oil prices by a penny.
Wow.
So a cent.
Yeah.
Which, so, it, you know, and that's after all of these years and so forth. And so the much better solution here is clearly to look at renewables, to make more energy-efficient cars, and to move forward with the technology and the clean technology that we do have, other than wasting our time and waiting 20 years down the road for, you know, a very little amount of oil.
Yeah, I've heard actually that if we just raise the gas mileage 1 mile per gallon, and even just SUVs, that it would wipe out the amount of oil we're actually going to get from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Perhaps if we just stop them from producing Hummers even these days. I drove by a place the other day and I saw about 15 Hummers, and I can't imagine who in their right mind these days, even if you don't care about the environment, who would be buying a Hummer with the gas prices. Obviously, they're not going down anytime soon. I don't see how that's going to happen. So, basically, yeah.
Read it on the way down, too.
Exactly. This issue has so many connections to other issues that people are obviously concerned with. So I think it's a really critical thing that I'm hoping people will respond to. And obviously, Sierra Club and UNH and other people have done that, so that's great. I want to ask you, as somebody who works with the Sierra Club, what your thoughts are, because I've heard this theory too, because obviously it seems, based on what has been reported by the environmental community, that a lot of oil companies don't even want to touch this, as far as because of the bad press, but also I've heard because there simply isn't enough oil to deal with up there,
right,
with all that they're going to have to go through to get it. There's some people who said this is more to do with just kind of a slap in the face to environmentalists. In other words, this was kind of the prize of, you know, the big, this was the pride and joy of the environmental movement, the fact that this place has been protected, this wilderness, this one of the last places on Earth like this.
Right.
So a lot of us have heard that this move to drill there is less to do with oil and more to do with undermining the environmental movement in this country, and to kind of basically a slap in the face, and we're going to do whatever it is we want to do, as the Bush administration would. And same thing with the Kyoto Protocol and all these other... And so, I guess, I don't know if you can speak on that, but that's just one of the theories out there, that it's less to do even with the oil, it's more to do with the power over the environmental movement. It's basically do whatever it wants.
Right, exactly. And that's very true. I mean, it's been seen year after year that the American public opposes drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And study after study, whether it be by the U.S. Geological Survey or the U.S. Department of Energy's Energy Information Administration, that it's just not an effective thing to do. It makes no sense. And the majority of Americans support that. The Alaska Coalition actually released a poll in January that says that 53% of Americans oppose drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, while 35% support it in a straight up or down vote. But then when you go to the budget and including it and the backdoor approaches they're doing now, which, like you're saying, is just basically a slap in the face of not only environmentalists, but the American people and the public land system that we've built up over years and that we take much pride in as a country. And so the budget, the numbers for the people that support sneaking and using this backdoor approach to include the drilling in the Arctic in the budget is even stronger. And 73% of Americans oppose drilling revenues in the budget, and 18% of them support it. I mean, so it just shows you that drilling in the Arctic refuge is too important to the American people and too important to future generations to be snuck through with this backdoor approach and, you know, used as a slap in the face for environmentalists and the American people.
It's a good point, because I said environmentalists, but I guess I think of somebody who cares about clean water and clean air as an environmentalist.
Exactly.
And I think we need to start defining that, as rather than letting people that are really anti-environmental policy define environmentalists as some special interest group. Obviously, if you care about clean water and clean air and existing, then you should be an environmentalist. So, you know, that's basically what it is. So.
Right, exactly. And just generally healthy communities, to me, it's this notion of being an environmentalist or a conservationist and all of these things, which is really, I mean, to me, it's about the basis of our life. It's about the earth that we live on, that, I mean, as we're seeing in the Gulf Coast right now, I mean, that nature can come back and get us and is very strong, and we need to live in balance here with this. And so something that all Americans really care about if they care about their families and their lives and so forth. So.
And perhaps there should be some places left alone as wilderness. That's one of the things I heard a senator talking, and I don't remember who it was a while ago, but about drilling there and how nowadays the technology and the impact would be minimal. And all I kept thinking was, you just don't get it. It's wilderness. As soon as you set foot in there and build anything,
right,
you're destroying what wilderness is, not just, you know, the animals out there or the plants or the tundra or whatever happens to be in a certain place, but it's the idea that humans don't linger there,
right,
or at least not modern developed societies. I mean, as you said, the Gwich'in people have been there for thousands of years and have managed to sustain themselves there without destroying their environment. And this is just one more thing, along with global warming, that's going to be a real detriment to their culture and to their way of life, which I think, personally, it robs all of us of our humanity and of our connection to the planet. So this is actually a very political, but it's also very spiritual and very practical in a lot of ways.
Exactly. I agree. And if you're thinking about, I mean, in practical in the sense, if you're looking at the economics of it, or if you're looking at being efficient, if you're looking at being sustainable and being able to live for, you know, thousands of years, that this is not the way to do it, and this is not the solution. But one other thing that you just touched on was that, you know, they talk about being able to build oil rigs and so forth that would have very little impact on the land there. And, I mean, that simply is just not going to be what we see happen there. They would have to build huge pipelines. They would have to build large gravel areas. They would have to build large docks. I mean, there's just a large amount of infrastructure that is needed to be able to run an oil drilling facility. So that's just another one of those myths. And then also, if we just look 60 miles west of the Arctic Refuge, you can see the effects of oil development on Alaska's North Slope in Prudhoe Bay, where one of the largest industrial oil complexes in the world, and it sprawls over 1,000 square miles across the tundra, and averages about 400 self-reported spills each year. And there are all kinds of different statistics you hear about this, but generally you hear that there's some kind of minor spill that happens there almost every day.
Mm-hmm. These are self-reported.
So that, yeah, 400 self-reported. Exactly. So that's what, you know, they're reporting.
And also thinking about the noise level and the air pollution that would be created in an area that's relatively pristine. At least, as you said, it's already been hammered by this other facility. And the noise level alone from helicopters and constant industry is loud. And oil, of all industries, is one of the loudest and dirtiest industries. And so it flies in the face of reality, of course, that this isn't going to have an impact. But they have, as far as, you know, well, we have this. And the technology probably is better, but better isn't necessarily...
is not going to make it okay.
Exactly.
And still will destroy this vast, pristine area.
So what do you think, or what does the Sierra Club want people to do specifically? Talk to your center and just say that they don't want this at all? And is there any other, I guess, part of this that, other than just saying no, is there any other part that can come back if this gets shut down at this point? What's the next step, I guess, to make it more permanent resistance or...
And the reality is that only time will tell what they'll come up with next, and they've been coming up with all of these backdoor approaches and things. And so basically, this road is one of the largest, and they have been trying this year after year, and we have won consistently. And so another vote where we are shutting them down and we're not allowing them to move forward, hopefully is one vote closer to the end of this ongoing fight. And so, I mean, it's really just critical right now that we call our representatives and that we ask them to vote against any budget package, including authorizing oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
You want to give those numbers out again?
That would be great, yeah. So Congressman Jeb Bradley's phone number is 202-225-5456. So it's Congressman Bradley, 202-225-5456. Congressman Charlie Bass, 202-225-5206. Congressman Bass at 202-225-5206. And then Senator Sununu is 202-224-2841. And Senator Gregg is 202-224-3324. And then also, if people are interested in getting involved further or getting more information, we'd love to talk with people. We'd love to get people volunteering. We're doing all kinds of things here in the office, from alerting our members to what's going on, getting our members to call. We have several different events that will be likely happening here. So it'd be great if they gave us a call. And our number here in Concord is 603-224-8222. So that's 603-224-8222.
All right. Well, thank you, Emily, and we'll look forward to talking to you sometime after the vote happens, and hopefully we'll both be sitting here smiling, saying, yeah. But if not, the fight will go on, because this place is just really important to protect. It represents a lot of things. And I think what's interesting is I've heard other people say that even though they know they'll never get there to visit, because it's unlikely most of us will actually go there,
right,
it's still important to have places like that on this planet. To know it's there is just incredibly important.
Exactly.
All right, well, thank you. Appreciate your time, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.